This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After I spoke with political reporters Jeff Whalen and Josh Margolin about covering New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy and his resignation, I spoke with McGreevy. He resigned and came out in his speech of August 12, 2004. McGreevy has written about his formerly secret gay life in his new memoir, The Confession. And he writes about Golan Sapel, the man McGreevy says he had an affair with while serving as governor. McGreevy had appointed Sapel Homeland Security Advisor. Jim McGreevy, welcome to Fresh Air. Your new book tells about your relationship with Golan Sapel, but you didn't mention him in your resignation. And the resignation, you said, given the circumstances surrounding the affair and its likely impact upon my family and my ability to govern, I've decided the right course of action is to resign. Maybe at the risk of asking the obvious, how come you didn't mention him and your relationship with him when you resigned?
Well, at the time, Terry, we were facing the prospect of a potential civil litigation, and that was the advice of counsel. But why I resigned is that I needed to take ownership of my bad judgment, my failed decisions, and also the prospect of trying to manage the state of New Jersey as governor and continue to be involved in the prospect of civil litigation would have just been untenable.
Were you blackmailed by him?
As I saw it, yes. Yes. I mean, his attorney asked for, as I describe in the book, for $50 million, and that number came significantly down. But yeah, it was a request for dollars. And obviously, I was intent upon hiding a secret that I had held with me the entirety of my life, namely that I was gay, and I had entered into this ridiculous relationship by virtue of my own error in judgment. But that was a truth, that was a reality that I didn't want to be exposed.
Do you think that had it not been for the fact that you had this relationship with somebody who you'd given a job to, a Homeland Security job, no less, that if it wasn't for that relationship, if you had come out and said, I am a gay American, do you think you would have had to resign?
No. If I had done it, quote unquote, right, if I had sort of come to terms with myself, sort of addressed my wife in a generous spirit and sought her understanding. You know, the citizens of the state of New Jersey, Terry, when I came out, were incredibly kind and overwhelmingly positive, not in terms of the imbroglio or the incident, but in sort of affirming me as a human being. But the sad reality is, but for Golan, I think I still would have been in the closet. I would not have been able to muster the courage to deal with that essential truth. And ironically, Golan became a blessing, which coerced me, which required me to set forth on a major life correction.
The person who you now describe as having been a blessing is now saying that you're a liar, that you never had an affair with him, you never had a sexual relationship with him. What's your reaction to what he's saying now?
Well, again, the book is painfully true. I've set forth my reality, and the purpose of the book, Terry, is to talk about the dangers of leading a double life, the dangers of leading a divided life, and for me, a closeted life. So what I've said is entirely true. Golan's remarks are his. They're false. But the purpose of the book is to talk about my reality, and is not to be condemnatory of anyone else, but to move forward on this journey, to take responsibility for my actions, and to move forward, and hopefully to share this narration and to start a clean slate.
You met Golan Sapel in Israel and brought him over to New Jersey and then made him your Homeland Security Advisor. Now, you say in your book that you fantasized about him from the moment that you locked eyes on him. Did you bring him here because you had, you know, these feelings for him? And did you appoint him to your staff because of the feelings that you had for him?
I think, Terry, it was more of a progression. I mean, when I met Golan Sapel for the first time, I mean, there was an immediate attraction, both physically, intellectually, if you will, psychologically. I brought him over actually to work on the campaign and to work with the various Jewish organizations throughout the state of New Jersey. And New Jersey is the most wonderfully diverse state in the nation, but, you know, I was dealing with Orthodox communities, Reformed, conservative, secular communities. And Golan, as an Israeli, I mean, he had a unique skill set. He was bright. And I brought him over to work on the campaign. And then, you know, subsequently, a relationship developed.
And then you made him your Homeland Security advisor. And a lot of people have wondered, of all the positions to appoint him to, given how covert your relationship had to be, why make him Homeland Security advisor, particularly since as an Israeli, he wouldn't even have security clearance in the United States. He wasn't a citizen.
Sure. If I could just clarify, I mean, putting Golan Sepel on the payroll was a humongous exercise in bad judgment. But I just want to also clarify, I mean, he was not Homeland Security czar. That responsibility belongs to the Attorney General in the state of New Jersey and something called the Domestic Security Preparedness Task Force, of which Golan was not a member. He was on the governor's staff. He advised me on Homeland Security and other issues. And it was just an incredible lapse in bad judgment. And I ought not have done it. And if I could redo it, I would have.
Now, you write in your book, The Confession, that even though you made up your mind to behave in public as though you were straight, you carried on sexually with men, scores of men, in seedy bookstores, public parks. Can you talk a little bit about why? I mean, do you think that the scores of men and the seedy bookstores and public parks, did that have to do with being closeted? I mean, do you think if you weren't closeted that you would have had... that you wouldn't have that, wouldn't have had those kinds of relationships?
Yeah, I think, you know, being open and accepting oneself and in an honest, committed relationship, I mean, the bright light of day changes all of that. And the irony is what was public in terms of, you know, perceptions of my wife and my heterosexuality was grossly inauthentic. And what was authentic was the fact that I was gay. But because I thought that I couldn't celebrate and accept my sexuality in the bright light of day, it was something relegated to shadows and to dark alleys. And it became such a corrosive, shameful place. And, you know, if there's a larger message in the book besides me attempting to, you know, set the record straight and establishing a new baseline of truthfulness in my own life, it's also sort of sharing how, you know, the closet and how my inability to be open results in corrosive acting out, which was, for me, unhealthy, ungodly, and destructive.
Let me ask you, in terms of remaining closeted, how much of it do you think was coming out would be really bad for my career, I couldn't really function in American politics, and how much of it was that you just didn't, you were brought up in such a way to think, like, this isn't good, it's shameful to be gay, I can't be gay, therefore I will remain closeted. So in other words, how much of it was just, like, kind of political, and how much of it was more personal?
I think some of the positions that I took were political. I was against gay marriage. I mean, we moved forward on a domestic partnership, which was a great thing in the state of New Jersey. I think we were the third state in the nation to do so. But from political positions, I think some of that was political because, I didn't want to appear gay. I wanted to go after this you know, what I perceived to be this middle stream. But I think what drove me personally was all the former. I mean, it were the impressions that I sort of garnered as a young person. It were, you know, the impressions that I had heard or that I had read as to the church's theology, as to the intellectual or the academic or thinking of the time. And those were deeply imprinted upon me. And also my actions, Terry, after that imprint only exacerbated that shame. I mean, because when people tell you that it's perverted and it's an abomination and you're acting out in anonymous trysts and that you know that it's not a committed, monogamous, healthy relationship, it just substantiates the premise upon which you accept that shame. And it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think at its core, I viewed it as something terribly unhealthy and damnable.
You describe in your book having gone to what you describe as go-go bars, strip clubs. And this was a period in which there were rumors circulating that you were gay. And were you hoping to be recognized or not be recognized? Like, you describe this as kind of part of the play, you know, part of the theater of looking straight. But you were probably with colleagues who didn't want to be seen there, right? Because who in politics really wants to be seen at a strip club? So what went through your mind?
It was an interesting, you know, psychological perspective, insofar as sort of I know early on, you know, who and what I am as a gay person, but then you almost have to create this image consciously in the minds of others as well as in your own mind, so that you can flicker that perspective on the screen of being straight, of being heterosexual. And so I was intent, and now this was political as opposed to, you know, personal or sexual. I was intent on being, quote unquote, masculine machismo. And you know, this sort of sad, sick irony is, as opposed to reflecting, you know, the sort of the loving, balanced, healthy relationship of my parents, who just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary, you know, you run to stereotype. You run to, you know, that flagrant philanderer. And so that's what I wanted the boys to know. That's what I wanted the political culture to know, that I was as masculine, I was as irresponsibly heterosexual as, ironically, I was secretly in terms of my gay life.
So what was it like to be in strip clubs with, you know, women dancing on the poles or whatever they were doing, when you were really, really gay and not interested in this at all?
Terry, it was just, it was just so ridiculous. I mean, I had no basic interest in what was happening, and it's all a facade. It was all pretend. It was acting in the worst way, and it was, and again, what was so disingenuous about it was, not only did I not have an interest there, and I had to feign an interest so that my colleagues would see that I was sort of robust and quote-unquote red-blooded American, but it became corrosive to me that the more you act distinct from who you are, it just divides, you know, the moral quality of that, you know, of my identity.
My guest is former New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy. His new book about his formerly secret gay life is called The Confession. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim McGreevy. He resigned as governor of New Jersey and came out in August 2004. His new memoir is called The Confession. One of the things you write about in the book that's gotten a lot of attention is that the night you first had an intimate physical relationship with Golan Sapel was a night when your wife was in the hospital recovering from a cesarean section. Your baby had just been born, and people think that the timing of that was, you know, a lot of readers, I think, or think that the timing of that was just so so awful. Yeah.
It was unforgivable. But Terry, I just saw the need, you know, in the book to be rigorously truthful, to be honest, and not to cut myself any slack. And I fully, you know, take responsibility for the, I almost can't find words for the inhumanity or the lack of compassion in that action. And it's also a, you know, product of the divide itself. I mean, in a strange, warped way. I mean, I just was over here in terms of my sexuality, and then over here as a husband and father, and in two different places. And I think it speaks to what happens when somebody isn't integrated. You know, as my friend Curtis and I sort of narrate this in the book, that the root of the words for integrity and integrated, you know, have a common root, and that lack of integration, that lack of healthy spirituality created this false division that allowed me to compartmentalize in a warped manner.
You know, it's awkward doing this interview in a way, because I feel like on the one hand, it's not my job here to be sitting in judgment of you. On the other hand, just like being here and reacting to the book and what you're saying, I find myself going through what probably a lot of people are going through, which is trying to decide how much do we kind of forgive the ill judgment that you had as governor in appointing Golan Sapel to the positions that you did and in having that affair with him. How much do we forgive that because, hey, society is the way it is and that kind of, you know, forced you in the closet? And how much do you not get off the hook because you were in the closet? How much, like, closet or no closet, there's a level of accountability
of
and responsibility as governor that there's just, you know, nothing gets you off the hook on that.
Well, I'm in the latter camp. I mean, I don't think I ought to get off the hook. I mean, being gay, there might have been bad images and reflections that I internalized, but that doesn't get you off the hook for bad judgment. But being that divided self denies me, and I should speak in the first person, denied me any sense of happiness. Because that if I wasn't going to be truthful, if I wasn't going to accept who and what I am, if I wasn't going to be totally honest, I couldn't be godly, as I said, with a small g, in the sense of being having a relationship that was based in goodness. I could never get to happiness. And so the purpose of the book is to show the narration from the truth to godliness with that small g to happiness, and to show how that was not only denied, but just the exact opposite happened in the bifurcated self. You know, the ego thinks that I could have managed it. Based in shame, my sexuality is relegated to dark shadows. I act out inappropriately, unethically, and the entirety of what I think I could falsely manage collapses. And the ultimate reward for me, and I have that quote from Seneca in the beginning of the book, is that I needed a radical correction. I would have continued down this godless, amoral path but for this collapse. And, you know, whether I was acting in a wrongful way, in an unspiritual way, outside the laws of God and man, or whatever caused this collapse, you know, in retrospect, it was grace, because it forced me to confront the painful reality of who I am.
Listening to you describe your experiences, it sounds like maybe you've been in therapy.
Yes. Yeah. And it's been healthy. I mean, I had an experience. I've done three things. I mean, I had the experience at a hospital called The Meadows in Arizona. I also participate in the 12-step program. I don't have a substance abuse addiction, but I think it's a wonderful spiritual journey in the sense of acknowledging one's dependence, acknowledging the importance of being truthful, sharing that truth with others. And I'm also blessed to work with a great doctor in the city of New York, Byron Karasu, who, if I can plug one book today, it would be his, The Art of Serenity. And he talks, and we talk, about the importance of that truthfulness, of that godliness with a small g, and that effort to seek happiness.
When I listen to you talk, it's almost as if you're talking about somebody else, that you're looking at this story and describing the shape of the story, almost as if it was somebody else's story.
No, it's maybe that's how maybe that's just how I'm telling it now. But no, it's been personal. It's been very searing, and it's very much my story, as imperfect and as it is.
Well, Jim McGreevy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Jim McGreevy is the former governor of New Jersey. His new memoir is called The Confession.